Well, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. Because it's Oscar night, I did a very unusual thing and had two people come to the studio on Saturday afternoon to pre-record this. I don't even know if they watch the Oscars, but I just thought, well, this would give me an opportunity to watch the Oscars while you listen to the fascinating conversation I'm about to have with a very old friend of mine, Shelley MacArthur Farley, who I knew as Shelley MacArthur, a stunning lounge singer in the day. Do you like that phrase, Shelley?
And talented. Lounge.
Yes, it was a place called, I knew her mostly from a place called the Gold Star Sardine Bar. And joining her is Bill, how do you pronounce your last name?
Freyr.
Okay, I went to Ireland this year. I should know how to pronounce everything. Bill is the creative and artistic director of, I used to mispronounce this and I will now, Shimsanagael.
You got it.
Close enough. That's close enough.
You're Irish.
Yes, in many ways, Bill, in many ways, many of which I don't want to admit. This is an event I've been to a number over the years. It takes place this Tuesday at the Symphony Center. And what I love about it is it elevates the whole notion of St. Patrick's Day in this town, which too often is just relegated to, you know, kiss me, I'm Irish, buttons, and a lot of booze. There's so much more meaning to it. Don't you think that's, both of you, that that's one of the things that makes Shimsanagael a glorious Chicago event?
Absolutely. Yeah, we wanted to offer a gift to the city, a little bit more than the green beer, and something a little more substantial or classical. Something sharing the history and the art of the Irish and Celtic people in Ireland and throughout the world as they mix with other cultures and create new types of music and art having mixed with other cultures.
Well, and people don't often realize the astonishing cultural impact of the Irish people. Yes, there's some great writers. Ooh, there's some great music. I was talking a few weeks ago with Liz Carroll,
who
is arguably the greatest fiddle player in the country.
Oh, in the world.
In the world.
And she's in our show. Liz is. Yeah.
She's in this show?
Yeah.
Wow.
She's
the guy. Wow.
Yeah.
Shelley, how did
is
you...
Is she every year in the show? No, just this year.
Probably every second or third year she is.
It's amazing.
Yeah, because she's busy, and she, well, understandably busy. Now, Shelley Farley, Shelley MacArthur Farley, how do you... I'm not even going to talk to you, Bill.
Transition,
about
Rick?
No. How do you accept the arduous chore, you and your husband, Bill, of being co-chairs with this with Virginia Norm Bobbins and Lynn and Jim Kelly? That's a big responsibility, isn't it?
It is a big responsibility, but, you know, I'm very passionate, number one, about Bill. I have to say that it's really Bill that I believe in him. I really do.
Yeah.
And I have really... In the last 10 years, I really only try to do things that I'm really passionate about. And Old St. Pat's is one of those institutions that I feel I would like to do whatever I can for them.
How long have you been going to Old St.
Pat's? Oh, wow. Long time. I want to say 22, 23 years.
Shimsanagael's been going on for...
I want to say the 22nd year. I have sung in this particular program twice, which was really powerful.
Yeah.
It really was powerful.
You sing in the choir, though.
First soprano. Hello, Rick.
You are?
Oh, yes. Not only am I slung over the piano, I do first soprano.
Well, the great thing is that would be great if they serve booze during mass.
No, you don't have to do that.
But we do serve booze during choir rehearsals. During the break.
Bill, how far back do you go with Old St. Pat's?
About the same amount of time. I've been there since 91.
Because one of the things about Old St. Pat's and all the proceeds from Shimsanagael go to benefit various programs at Old St. Pat's.
Correct.
The Old St. Pat's story is one of the most astonishing in the history of this town. This church had, as I've heard from John Cusick and John Wall, who came into what was then Skid Row to try to save this place, it didn't even seem as if it could be saved. There were, you know, four drunken parishioners and nothing else. Don't you think it's both of you, something of a small...
Old St. Pat's is really an extraordinary experience. And to to really validate that, my husband, who is Irish, 99% Irish, was raised Catholic.
What's that other percent, though?
I don't know what the other percent
is. What is that? That sounds strange. 1%
yeah, that does
something.
Sound weird, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, no, I like it. I
don't know that 1%.
The mystery 1%
exactly.
for Bill.
But he, but he literally started going back to church because of Old St. Pat's and the priests that were at Old St. Pat's. It is such an extraordinary parish. It's a community.
It is.
And we're going
yeah.
to Rome in April with Jack Wall, Father Jack Wall, for he's doing a celebration of his priesthood years for 50 years. We have an audience with the Pope. I'm very excited.
Jack's been a priest for 50 years.
Yes. Yeah. And he so anyhow, so I got Bill, or Bill came with me, or what have you, to Old St. Pat's, and since then he has continued going. It's one of the few churches, and there's some beautiful churches in the city of Chicago,
yeah.
but the priests there are so connected with what's happening today.
Well,
today,
I think, you know,
and
Shelley,
that is the key word.
I think one of the reasons for that is when Jack and John first went there, you necessarily had to be connected with your environment, because the environment was a beleaguered, beaten-up environment. And I think that's just carried through as the more rarefied crowd came into that, so to speak. Maggie Daly, and I think one of the reasons that church did take off is the Daly started going there.
Sure.
And Maggie, one of the loveliest people I have ever met, and a person so committed not just to the city, but to the arts. Jack, obviously, Jack Wall, Father Jack Wall, or whatever you call priests these days, obviously picked the right person to put the arm on to start Shims and a Gale. She and Mrs. Ryan are the ones
Correct.
Who started this. What was Jack's original idea? What is it along the lines of my thought to sort of have a more meaningful celebration around St. Patrick's Day?
Yes, absolutely. That was Jack's exact idea, to do something a little bit more for the city of Chicago that was more cultural. It was the 150th anniversary of the celebration of Old St. Pat's, and it was also, there had been a famine remembrance suite that had been written and done at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York.
And we
said, well, if they could do it in New York, we could do it here in Chicago.
What were you doing at that time when he put the arm on you two to get involved? You've been at Old St. Pat's for a long time.
Right. Yeah, I came in 91. I had been at the oldest cathedral in California at that time, Old St. Mary's Cathedral in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
And then I came here.
To do what?
I came here to be the director of music at Old St. Pat's, worship music, and then it just kept on growing, numbers of choirs, and then we started to do concert programs. The first one being, I think, Deck the Hall, and then Shimsa was next.
Well, I have been listening to Shelley MacArthur Farley sing for almost 30 years now. I've reviewed her. I would like to know what you think of her. She's obviously, and I'm going to say this, she's obviously gotten better, has she not?
Oh, she has. Yeah. One of my favorite stories, I remember being at Park West, and it was a cabaret night, and there were all kinds of cabaret singers, you know, getting up there. Well, it was probably about 20, 25.
Yeah.
And one was better than the other, and better and better and better, and I thought, this is stiff competition, and I was hoping for you, and I was there for you, and she got up there, and she knocked it out of the park.
Thank you.
Was like, you know, you absolutely belonged there, and it was some of the best talent around, and you were right there, if not better than a number of them.
Do you know, the interesting thing is singing that genre, which is wonderful, but you know, one of my true passions is doing classical, and that's why I loved singing at Old St. Pat's in the choir, because I love to use my soprano voice, and I've had the opportunities of being able to sing with Rod Dixon, who is going to be performing
in
the show.
Oh, wow, who's going to be in the Tuesday, yeah.
Along with his wife, and he's an extraordinary tenor, and we've done shows together, and we've had such a wonderful time because we've been able to mix the different genres of music between classical and not pop, but jazz, and it's been really great. But singing in Old St. Pat's Choir is one of the most, and I'm not exaggerating, powerful experiences I've ever had.
Wow.
And when you see this show...
As you should, you ladies and gentlemen, Tuesday night, yeah.
Tuesday night, you will cry at the end.
Wow.
Because it's so moving and it's so uplifting when you have all the voices of, I think there's, what, 100 people in the choir, Bill?
There's going to be a total of 125, 130.
You've got, I mean, we'll talk in a moment about everything that's involved in the show, because you've got the great Catherine O'Connell as part of the thing. And I saw it is Saturday, ladies and gentlemen. It's not Sunday. This has been recorded on Saturday. I saw Bill and Catherine on, like, I don't know, one of these goofy morning news shows for about a vast 3-minute segment. And the horrible part of it was they cut Catherine's song off to have an ad for Wendy's. And I said, this is something. Something is not right with the world when they do this. When they do this kind of thing.
I heard it was White Castle.
Oh, you're
better
right.
Than Wendy's.
It was White Castle. At least it's a cooler brand. Just to prove that I'm real and I didn't bug out because I did a recording of these two lovely people talking about Shimson and Gale. This is Rick Hogan live in the studio, but what you're going to hear now is part two of this, I think, intriguing interview. So here you are. You must work on this, putting together Shimson and Gale, all year long, Bill, do you not?
Oh yeah. It takes a number of years. I mean, I already have things for the next 2 years that I'm working on.
What intrigues me, though, too, is it has ever been themed. Who comes up with the notion of how to theme a year's program? I'm sure it's you and maybe even Shelley and some other people sitting around thinking, well, this year we should devote it to blank.
Correct. That's how it happens. It's, I enlist the wisdom of lots of people. We have an artistic committee. Shelley's been on our artistic committee. Rod Dixon, Catherine O'Connell, Joy Tillis, Jimmy Moore. Jack Wall, Tom Hurley.
What about that John Cusack guy? You don't let him on the creative team?
We love John Cusack.
No, I'm always asking people, do you have any ideas? Or, are there any places that I've never heard of where the Irish diaspora intersects, with other cultures? So it's just a matter of being attentive to what people are saying, doing research. And then
you,
the wisdom of many different people.
Well, and then you are charged with going out and finding,
correct,
the talents to bring that theme to life.
Yeah.
It can't be too difficult in Chicago. There's some big talents here.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Just one other thing on the previous questions. We used to do things that were already, put together, like a number of pieces by Sean Davey and Liam Lawton and Patrick Cassidy. And then we started running out of pieces of music around Irish art and music that were already put together, so we had to start creating things. And so that's
a wonderful challenge for you, though, is it not?
Necessity is the mother of invention. So that's been wonderful. And yet we have great talent in Chicago to pick from. I mean, I think the best Irish trad musicians are here in the city of Chicago.
I agree.
And but some of, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead,
Sean. You've also used, but you have these extraordinary narrators from all over the country. I mean, very famous people. Tell Rick some of your incredible people
our very first one was, I think, Gabriel Byrne, but one of the most memorable ones was Gregory Peck.
Oh, my
God. And the first time you...
All right, Bill, how do you get Gregory Peck, who I am not sure has any huge, strong, he didn't play for the Bears or anything. How do you get Gregory Peck to come to an event like this, a one-shot-only thing, to act as a narrator?
You know, there's just so many different people that come to Old St. Pat's that know so many other different people.
Good point.
And with
good point.
The likes of Shirley Ryan and Maggie Daly I mean, the likes of Shelley Farley and Shirley Ryan and Maggie. I mean, that's really how we...
I must ask you, was Gregory Peck any good?
Oh, he was fantastic. And
Martin Sheen.
And Martin Sheen and John Malkovich and Bonnie Hunt and Joan Cusack. I know I'm leaving. Brian Dennehy.
Brian Dennehy.
And
John Mahoney. Carol Marine was one of the best
Mahoney.
Ones.
Wow.
one of the Ponce people.
What do they do, the celebrated? You have three very interesting ones this year, too. What do they read? What are they narrating?
Yeah, there's a... we write a narrative story that goes with it, so it's interspersed.
Who's we?
Different people, but this year it's Mary Evers and myself that write it.
Another sort of a narrative that strings together story and song.
Right.
That is a great idea.
Yeah, it's very unusual. I mean, you don't find it anywhere else.
Yeah,
storyline of the music.
Because it makes it seamless.
Spend a lot of time on that, Bill. I mean, it's a.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
But it also, both of you, Shelley, and that it makes giving it a narrative makes it less a kind of variety show. Do you know
Correct.
What I mean?
Yeah,
even though you have great performance, it's not a variety
show. It's not a variety show. It's a movement.
Yeah.
It's a cultural movement, I think, that you feel when you're sitting in the hall. I feel that you are really learning and experiencing the different culture at that time, because you're going through a story with these different singers and then intertwined with the musicians, who are wonderful, and the Irish
stellar.
Musicians are there, and then the Irish dancers, and now with Melody Hobson's After School Matters choir.
Yeah, we've had them with us three different times, After School Matters.
Yeah.
And this year we have, again, Trinity Irish Dance. And we also have a dancer from 42nd Street that was just out at Oak Brook.
Right, right.
Devon Suttles is going to be doing some tap dance.
My mother's going to love that.
Oh, yay. Yeah, he's a great dancer. And Katie Grennan, an Irish step dancer, just was at CSO this past January.
The show generally, in years past, not all 22 years or 21 years, has been a sellout. The money, again, goes to benefit various programs at Old St. Pat's. I would like you to go to the Old St. to buy tickets to go to the Old St. Pat's. .com. You can get them on that website, because I want people to experience. Old St. Pat's is just a treasure here. And the more you know about Old St. Pat's, the better off you will probably be. One year it had to move. And I saw it at the
auditorium.
Tell me I was not loaded or something, but I did see it at the auditorium theater.
It really did happen.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It did happen.
That was just because Symphony Center was busy.
You know, I've gotten to that age where I can't remember.
Good. Yes,
that is
good. I think that's probably
we're like-minded and lacking memory, Bill. I have to assume that there are people who have probably gone every single year. And so there is a onus on you, a certain responsibility on both of you, Shelley MacArthur Farley, in being a co-chair with your husband Bill, of not reinventing it every year. I get the sense that it is really a responsibility that both of you feel to not be repetitious, to not do the same thing, to really discover new elements that enliven not just the show, but enlivens people's feelings of what it means to be Irish.
Absolutely.
Well, and Bill, you know, you years in advance, I think, as you said, you're working on something for 2 years. You know, and it's also very complicated to get scheduling down with certain people a year in advance, especially for celebrity people, to have them. And the choir, I might add, it's such a blessing, and they are really angels, because they rehearse 2 days a week for, I want to say, starting in
September.
Rick, which is why I'm wayward.
You never have to rehearse, Shelley.
Are you kidding? When you work with Bill, you got to rehearse. He's got a pointer stick at rehearsals.
That's called a baton.
Sorry.
Bill, there are all manner of logistical challenges to this thing. How often do you rehearse? Do you do a full run-through before the show, which is Tuesday? Maybe you're doing it this afternoon. I don't know.
No, we have a difficult time doing a complete run-through.
How bad?
We have a rehearsal. We'll have a rehearsal Monday for the first time with the orchestra, the Irish Trad Band, the dancers, the singers, and the choir. And but both choirs, Old St. Pat's and After School Matters. And then Tuesday afternoon at around 3 o'clock, we start putting it all together at Symphony Center.
Wow.
And do a run-through at 4:15.
I suppose it's an idiotic question, but have you ever been tempted or seduced to do this more than once? You know, one show is one show, and it makes it very special, and it makes it unique. But I've got to think somewhere along the line people have said, hey, Bill, let's take this show on the road, or let's do it for a weekend, or let's do it for 3 days. Has that happened?
People say that all the time. In fact, Shelley's husband has said that.
Did he really?
But then you turn around and say, well, would you help produce it? And then he doesn't say it
and
anymore.
And then he goes, well, thank you, no, yeah.
But it's costly, though.
Oh, it really
But it's always
costly.
Been thought
oh, no
of.
Question.
I mean, it should be repeated.
Yeah, I think so,
It should be repeated.
Yeah.
But it's just getting all the right people in alignment.
More coming after the news with Bill Farrar and Shelley MacArthur Farley from Old St. Pat's talking about Chimps in the Yale. That's the fiddle of Liz Carroll, the greatest fiddle player on the planet and a Chicago girl. Now comes the conclusion on After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, of the interview with creative artistic director Bill Farrar and great singer, also one of the co-chairs of the Chimps in the Yale bash that goes on at the Symphony Center on Tuesday. You can get all the information and tickets at oldstpats.org or cso.org. Here is Bill and Shelley. One of the really intriguing, as Shelley and Bill have been talking, you know, Broderick Dixon's going to be there, Catherine O'Connell,
Gavin Coyle,
the Old St. Pat's concert choir, the Trinity Irish Dancers, the Metropolis Symphony Orchestra, Gavin Coyle, Elfrida Burke, they're going to be soloists in this thing. What intrigues me terribly is basically the narrative here is the story of two slave liberators.
Correct. Yeah.
One of whom I certainly know, but only vis-a-vis America, and the other one, even though I went to Ireland for a few days this year, I'm no expert in Irish heritage and culture, Daniel O'Connell and Frederick Douglass. Talk to me, if you could, about that relationship. And did you know about this beforehand? I mean, this isn't come to news to you, right? You're pretty. You're more Irish than I am. Yeah.
We've kind of touched on it a number of times before, but we always go at it from a different angle. Daniel O'Connell was called the Liberator of Ireland,
right?
And he was the one that managed to pass through the Catholic Relief Act,
sure,
giving more rights for Catholics to own property, to vote, to marry outside of their religion. He was the one that made that possible. And Frederick Douglass, at the same time that Daniel O'Connell was alive doing all that, Frederick Douglass had written his book on slavery, the
right.
narrative of slavery.
Right.
And he feared for his safety because he named names in the book. So he traveled to Ireland.
And that's why he went to Ireland. That's fascinating.
For his own safety.
And then
subsequently, the Irish Quakers and the English Quakers paid $771 for his freedom from slavery. And the so you can say that the Irish and the Quaker English did pay for his freedom. When Douglass went to Ireland, he and O'Connell met up, and they traveled around the country speaking to huge crowds, speaking out against slavery in any form it took. Initially, historians say that Douglass was in favor of the South seceding, but after working with and talking with Daniel O'Connell, he came to the conclusion that slavery anywhere affects us everywhere.
That is just a great story.
It's a great, and isn't that timely right now? To have that happening, to have this show right now at this time.
Yeah,
it's so interesting how the universe works and things all come together. Not knowing, really, at the time when you had been thinking about this 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, but part of the program, the arc of it, goes towards the more than 30 million people involved in or trapped in slavery today.
Yeah,
and
I know.
The beginning of the program starts with slides of oppression in Ireland in the early 1800s, and then pre-Civil War slavery, and then contemporary slavery. So the idea is to look at the world today, but to look at it through the eyes of two people who succeeded in reducing.
You know, you really are. You're literally giving me chills talking about this thing.
Oh.
And I think that is, then you add, it's embellished with all this marvelous musical and dancing entertainment that you may be learning a terribly important, crucial history lesson that echoes in today, but it comes
absolutely.
At you.
Bill, are you ending the show with my very favorite song?
Go out and tell the story. Make them hear you from Ragtime.
Make them hear you. It's so... Oh, empowering. No, I'm not going to sing any of it, but it is chilling.
Yeah, it just I got chills.
With 125.
But one of the new songs that we're doing, it was made popular by Nina Simone. It's called I Wish I Knew.
Sinner Man, no, just joking.
I wish I knew how it felt to be free, something like that. It's a great piece of music. So, and you know, we're doing some gospel music. We're doing Irish music. We're doing
That's it. That has always been one of the hallmarks. I may not have been at one of the early ones, but it is this cultural stew. It is not this straight ahead.
You're right.
Everything Irish. It addresses the way that Irish arts and entertainment have influenced other cultures and how other cultures...
Or vice versa.
Exactly. How the Irish have been open to being influenced by other cultures.
The Irish have never colonized anything.
They
just moved into cultures and... You know,
they sort of
shared what they.
I will argue they sort of colonized Chicago politics at a time. At a time, they colonized Chicago politics. Who is narrating? Before I let you two go, and again, Chimson and Gale is Tuesday. There are all sorts of ways. I'm not going to spell it for you, but I think the easiest way to do this is to go to oldstpats.com or
.org
or cso.org. And get tickets. I mean, if you've been listening to this, you must be intrigued. And remember that all the money raised from this is very expensive to put this on. Goes to Old St. Pat's
pay for the program.
Or there is a number you can call, which is 312.
People still use phones? Wow.
Oh, yes. They're cell phones, Rick. 312-294-3000.
That's great. Who is narrating, before I let you go, who is narrating this year? Let's think of someone really famous, like Brad Pitt.
I wish.
See? Yeah.
Liam Neeson.
Yeah, Liam Neeson, Brad Pitt.
It was on our call sheet. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah. No, but we have great narrators. We have.
Oh, you always have. You always have.
We have the Irish senator at large, you know, for the Irish diaspora, Billy Lawless.
Oh, God, great. Yeah, yeah.
And then we also have from another... station not to be mentioned, Leanne Trotter.
Oh, mention her. Leanne's a great friend of mine. Leanne's a great friend of mine.
We also have Brad Weddington is doing some of the narrative. He works with After School Matters. And,
fantastic.
Teaches theater, I think, at Columbia here in town. And then we have Daniel O'Connell's great, 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 great granddaughter, Patria Levy.
For real? Really?
For real. She's coming in from New York, and she's a dress designer. And she was just named.
I need to meet her.
Yeah, I was thinking of that. She was just named as one of the most influential Irish women in the world under the age of 40.
Well, that's great.
She's number 34, I think.
That's a huge honor. Shelley, what are you doing?
Start dressing the choir.
Yes.
Now, Shelley MacArthur.
They're wearing black and then sometimes a green necklace and green ribbon.
Shelley MacArthur Farley.
Yes.
You're singing at this thing?
I am not singing this year.
Could I somehow induce you to just stand up in the audience and start singing Cole Porter song?
I will do that.
It would be a dream come true for me.
We also have the great Lynn Kiley and Virginia.
Lynn Kiley and Virginia Bobbins, who have been very
great.
Great people to chair with.
You
actually,
too
I didn't sign on until I knew they were going to do it. So
that's right. At first she goes, well, who else do you have?
I did. I said, well, wait, just me or who else?
That's what all co-chairs say. Yeah, that's what all co-chairs. Who else you got? You got anybody else?
You know, but they have been so great to work with, and they're lovely people and very supportive. And we're all believers in Bill and Old St. Pat's.
Oh,
we're just so fortunate to be able to do this type of
program. Yeah, no kidding.
And it cannot happen without the likes of you and Lynn and Virginia and many other people.
It helps enrich the whole St. Patrick's Day experience here, which sometimes is really diminished to die the river, get drunk, kiss somebody. It enriches and elevates it to the status it should be. You two, Bill Farr, who's the artistic and creative director over at Old St. Pat's and Shimson and Gale, and Shelley MacArthur Farley, one of the legendary cabaret singers. I like to call it saloon. Sinatra was a saloon singer. That's not a bad
thing. Sinatra, yes, he was. And actually, I had a very wonderful experience with Sinatra. He was at Four Torches. Modeling days. And there was, I know. We used to hang at Four Torches.
That's
another show.
You can't tell that. That's another show.
That's another Shimsa.
Yes. You two, I know you'll probably be terribly exhausted by Wednesday, but it's a good exhaustion. You're doing God's work, man. Chicago's
really
work,
lovely.
Too.
It is
great to see you, Shelley. You bring back so many great memories. And Bill, it's a pleasure. We must know 800 people in common. Yeah. And don't let John Cusick. If Father Cusick wants a ticket, I'll even buy it.
He's got to go. Absolutely.
I'll buy it for him.
He comes every year.
But he sneaks in. He goes, I don't need a ticket.
No,
I'm Father Cusick. I know
he is. Absolutely.
I know he is. He's sweetheart. So are both of you.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having us.
That's not mine. Lise Graham, the world's greatest producer, and Debbie Silverman is responsible for this.
And Debbie Silverman, who's been really wonderful. But, I mean,
she got you your first gold star.
She sure did.
David Mamet is, without argument, the most famous playwright in the history of Chicago. I wrote about his new novel called Chicago, a book set in the 1920s. Last week, today in the Tribune, if you buy a newspaper, you can find a full review of his book. I'm not going to belabor that. David has a daughter named Willa, who is part of a duo, Willa Mamet and Paul Miller, who play around the country. He also has a wife named Rebecca Pigeon, who performs around the country. These are two of the most talented singers that I have heard recently. Here, first of all, and then I'll introduce Rebecca's song. Here is Willa Mamet and Paul Miller doing my old friend John Prine's, one of his great songs. John's written a million great songs. Here they are.
I am an old woman named after my mother. My old man is another child that's grown old. If dreams were thunder, lightning was desire, this old house would have burnt down a long time ago. Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to believe in this living is just a hard way to go. When I was a young girl, I had me a cowboy. He weren't much to look at, just a free rambling man. That was a long time, and no matter how I tried, the years just flow by like a broken down dam. Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can think is just a hard way to go. There's flies in the kitchen, I can hear them buzzing. I ain't done nothing since I woke up today. How the hell can a person go to work in the morning and come home in the evening and have nothing to say? Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to believe in this living is just a hard way to go. To believe in this living is just a hard way to go.
That is the guitar of Paul Miller and the voice of Willa Mamet, David Mamet's daughter, one of two daughters that he had with his first wife, Lindsay Krause, the actress. His second wife, with whom he has two children as well, is named Rebecca Pigeon. She has a number of CDs. All you have to do is Google her. We live in that age. Here she is. This is just a song of hers that I adore. It's a cover of a Beach Boys tune. Enjoy, ladies and gentlemen.
Wouldn't it be nice if we were older? Then we wouldn't have to wait so long. And wouldn't it be nice to live together in the kind of world where we belong? It's gonna make it that much better when we can say goodnight and stay together. Wouldn't it be nice if we could wake up in the morning when the day is new, and after having spent the day together, hold each other close the whole night through? What happy times together we'd be. That every kiss was never ending. Oh, wouldn't it be nice? Maybe if we think and wish and hope and pray it might come true, maybe then there wouldn't be a single thing we couldn't do. Oh, we could be married. Wouldn't it?
talented family that David Mamet has. His one of his other daughters, Osha, is one of the stars of the TV show Girls. That's Willa's sister. Willa plays with a man named Paul Miller. They have not performed in Chicago, unbelievably. Willa lives in on the West Coast, and Paul Miller lives in New England, and they have yet to come here, but I want them to come here. Rebecca Pidgeon, who is David's wife, who plays, she has such eclectic offerings. All you do, just look her up. It's P-I-D-G-E-O-N. Google her and you'll find a million things. I'm just, at the moment, terribly taken with her cover. I'm going to be Wednesday at the Cliff Dwellers Club talking about books and my career and all sorts of other stuff. But more to the point, Thursday at the Museum of Broadcast Communication, I know this station has done a lot of stuff about the Saturday Night Live exhibit at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, because Larry Wirt, who used to run this station, is now the interim head of the Museum of Broadcast Communications. There is a big Saturday Night Live show. There's an exhibit there, and if you haven't seen it, it's cool. But Thursday night, I'll be moderating a group of Second City alums, including Tim Kazurinsky, talking about the kind of farm team that Second City has always, and I mean always, been for Saturday Night Live. So Google that. Stay tuned. We're going to talk live. I'm here. This is Rick Kogan in the studio with producer Curtis Koch. Is it Koch? He's there. Aubrey Mumpower's here. And we're real. We're alive and we don't watch the Oscars. And I'm sure there are many discriminating people out there who don't care about the Oscars or will learn who won and lost tomorrow. We'll talk to artist Margie Lawrence after the news at 10, and then you'll hear an interview with the guy who created something called My Dad Wrote a Porn. It's a podcast that has had 100 million downloads, and they are now they're from Britain. Now one of the hottest live shows touring the United States of America. So you'll hear an interview there. So please stay tuned. That beep means it's 10 o'clock. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. As I said, it's 10 o'clock and here with the news. Welcome back. One of my favorite people and someone who is so passionate about Chicago, mostly all elements of Chicago, is Margie Lawrence, a brilliant visual artist. Margie, how are you? And thanks for coming on, and I hope I'm not dragging you away from the Academy Awards.
Well, I had to turn it off.
Well, was it any
so
good?
I could talk to you.
Well, give me, all right, well, give me your, how has it been so far? Exciting? I think they get more boring every year, frankly.
Well, it wasn't as political as I thought, but, you know, I go for the glam and people misbehaving.
Well, that's what I like to see, too. Margie, you have a new, your latest exhibition is at the Second Story Studio, 2251 West Devon. It opens on March 31st and runs through May 5th. It is called Baseball and Blues Portraits. You get better. Your website is amazing, and you seem to get you seem to grow as an artist. Do you sense that too, Margie? I know you've studied, and I know you painted, but with each passing painting or series of paintings, do you feel a sense of growth as an artist?
Well, I always give myself a challenge with every piece I do. And hopefully I conquer that challenge, and with it is growth and progress. I'm my worst self-critic,
yeah,
as we all are.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't see the growth you see.
Well, but one of the things, too, that I've ever found intriguing about your work, you're a child who grew up in the in the very close vicinity to Wrigley Field, and would go and would. But you know, the great thing, you went to games. You know, not the same era as I did, a little after me, but at a time when the game was somehow purer, and I think the players were almost more accessible. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't as I know the Ricketts won the World Series, and I know that was a big deal for you. But there was something a little, you know, sort of homier about the whole experience when we went to games when we were kids. That's how you could fall in love with it.
Well, there were 3,000 people at the ballpark.
Yeah. Now, who were, I know that among your all-time favorites were the great Ryne Sandberg and the also great Ron Santo. Those were two of your...
Paul and Sandberg. Well, yeah. And then there's Mr. Banks.
Of course. Well, and you have one of the interesting things, too. You say... And you've told me that your first memory of baseball is kind of sitting around with members of your family on a TV?
Yes.
Okay, take me back to that. It was in the early 60s. And what were you folks doing?
Well, it was the high holidays, and rather than going to Temple, we were watching the World Series and missing Sandy Koufax.
Yeah.
So the next day when the holiday was over, we were all gathered in front of the television. There was like 20 of us.
Oh, wow.
And it was like the first portable TV.
Oh.
You know, so we rolled it out into the living room because the family room wouldn't hold all of us. And I was watching Sandy Koufax.
Well, it was easy to fall in love with Sandy Koufax, I got to tell you. Not only was he... a great pitcher, but he was also incredibly cool. You fell hook, line, and sinker for baseball so much that you played baseball, and I think it's a sort of tragedy that at the time, you know, young women were not allowed to play Little League.
Oh, no. Plus, I took a line drive to the face, and
from one of those,
my mother liked my nose the way it was.
How did you? I know you spent a lot of time in Chicago theater, and then what brought you, Margie Lawrence, to the Art Institute to study? I mean, had you been drawing and doing things throughout your young life, and you thought?
No, my parents were artists,
right?
So I grew up with them in that environment. And as a theater major, we all had to take set design.
Oh, right, sure. Sure.
And I got offered a scholarship to Yale, but it was for set design, not acting.
Yeah. Huh. And
I got a full scholarship to the School of the Art Institute.
Now,
so that's how I ended up there.
Did you like the School of the Art Institute?
Well, yes and no.
Mm-hmm. Yes, why, and no why, yeah.
Yes, why, because it gave me access to computers.
Mm-hmm.
When computers were nascent, they were brand new. It was 1988.
Sure.
So anybody who could use it was a magician and got paid a lot of money.
Right, right.
Those old keyline and paste-up guys did not like me.
I'll bet. What about when you were hooked on baseball and players and portraits of players? Did the, I'm going to call them professors or teachers at the Art Institute, what did they think of that? You would think at some point they might think, well, that's not rarefied enough, or that's not.
You mean the arty farty?
Yeah, I mean the arty farty. What would they say when you'd say, here is my portrait of the great Ernie Banks? They probably, half these people didn't even know who Ernie Banks was. You know what I mean?
No. Everybody loved the Cubs.
Even the professors?
Especially the professors. Carl Wistrom, who's a very famous artist, has done museum-quality images of Harry Carey and the Cubs.
Sure.
You know, so They didn't mind it at all.
And they certainly encourage you to do it. What is it, Margie, you've done so many interesting pieces of old ballplayers who you obviously never saw in your life, such as Ted Williams and Josh Gibson and Bob Feller. And, you know, I know that that Jackie Robinson is a special hero of yours. What draws you as an artist to those people? I mean, some of it is the history of them in the game, but other things must be the sort of physicality of some of those players. I think especially. Go ahead.
Well, see, I have to work from obviously photographs.
Sure.
And so that is what intrigues me initially, is the image that I see, and then I learn about the player.
And obviously someone like you have a Ted Williams intrigues you. I mean, some of your recent work of Ted Williams all of your work is stunning and striking, but your stuff of Ted Williams is really something special, don't you think?
I love Ted Williams. Before I was like, who's this handsome guy? Because, you know, I'm a gal, so I look at him like that. And then I realized, oh, my God, this guy was, like, a great baseball player. And I was bringing this up to my dear old mom, who had told me a story that she had met him, and she had a Me Too moment with old Teddy Baseball.
Really? What did he do? What did he do?
Well, he was a little grabby.
Wow, I'll bet a lot of guys in those days in that sport were a little grabby.
If you saw my mom, you would understand.
I'm sure I would. You also, for this show, you can go to Margie's website and see her work and even buy it there. Margie, M-A-R-G-I, Lawrence, LAWRENCE.com. It's a great...
Actually, it's Margie, M-A-R-G-I-E.
Yeah. MARGIELAWRENCE. This show, the show that is opening late March, and I'm going to replay this closer to the date of the opening of the show. It opens on March 31st and runs through May 5th at the Second Story Studio at 2251 West Devon, where you have shown before. This is a combination of your baseball portraiture and your blues portraiture, which is equally stunning. When did you dive into the blues so passionately?
Well, I've always liked the blues. I grew up listening to the blues. My family, my mother especially, had brought in records of blues artists. My father grew up listening to gospel music, and he took me to see Aretha Franklin.
Oh, wow.
And I have a friend who's a manager of many blues artists here in town. And, you know, you got easy access to a lot of these people. And I've been going to the clubs for the last 40 years.
Yeah, well, you do a remarkable job of capturing, I think, the energy of Chicago blues. You also seem to have pretty good access, and the one image that struck me is Chris Bryant. I mean, obviously, members of the Cubs, as corporate as they can be now, they still must know you and respect you, don't they, Margie?
Well, I don't know if they know who I am.
They should know who you are. They should.
Well, you have their number?
I'll get in touch with them. I'll send that stuff over. Margie, you are really one of a kind, and you are a great artist. And anybody who goes...
Thank you.
You know I feel that way. Anybody who goes to your website will see your work. And one of the things about it is you're certainly passionate. Do you still go to many games? You still go to many Cub games?
I used to go to 45 games a year, and in 98, I went to every home game.
Wow.
Well, that was the year Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire
went crazy. Well, you must have had your heart broken in 1969, didn't you?
Oh, please.
Yeah, who did? But you also must have had your heart jump into your throat 2 years ago when they won the World Series. Can you
it
even?
It was a religious experience.
I think it was for everybody. Margie, go back and watch the Oscars. It's great talking to you, and I'll replay this. And we'll talk closer to the show. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Margie Lawrence, her latest exhibition is titled Baseball and Blues Portraits. It opens Saturday, March 31st at the Second Story Studio at 2251 West Devon, and it runs all the way through Saturday, May 5th. That would be the beginning, ladies and gentlemen, of baseball season. Baseball season starts in early April, so nothing better to get than one of her fantastic portraits of ballplayers in action. She brings a lot of passion, or blues men, and it's always blues season in Chicago. Margie, it's always great to talk to you. Go back and watch the Academy Awards. I really appreciate
it.
All right, honey. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. She's great. She's one of a kind. We're going to take some commercials, and then I've allowed Audrey Mumpower to play an Irish song because St. Patrick's Day is coming up. Welcome back. We just heard from Margie Lawrence, one of Chicago's greatest artists. In the last half hour of this program, you will hear another pre-recorded segment. It's a pre-recorded interview with a guy named Jamie Morton, who's one of the creators of My Dad Wrote a Porno. You can find a story about that on the cover of this Today's Tribune Arts and Entertainment section, written by me. This thing is fascinating. I know you hear a lot. We have a lot of podcasts on this station. This podcast, My Dad Wrote a Porno, which is the creative child of three young British, two are in the television business, one's in radio. It's had 100 million downloads. It's now on a sort of live performance tour of the United States, selling out in places like New York, Boston, Washington, Toronto, which, of course, is in Canada. They're going to be at the Chicago Theater. I'll tell you a bit more about them before you hear them. But because St. Patrick's Day is almost upon us, here is an Audrey Mumpower tune. He's not playing on it. He has just selected it. So enjoy.
Thank you.
Wow. Aubrey Mumpower, you're a genius. You should have been working at some kind of Irish. I'll get you a job in Dublin at some Dublin station now. That was a great tune. It featured the one and only Liz Carroll on fiddle. It's a CD. If you want to celebrate, I mean, we're coming up on St. Patrick's Day. The title of the CD is Ireland, Crossroads of Art and Design. It gives a little more substance to the, hey, kiss me, I'm Irish, and give me another green beer craziness that we sometimes undertake. Nothing wrong with that. I've had my share of green beers in my life, and nothing wrong with indulging, but sometimes lift it up a little, lift it up a little. Coming up, the creator of My Dad Wrote a Porn. You certainly don't want to miss that. These guys may one day win an Academy Award. That's all I can say about them. They're young, and they'll be at the Chicago Theater on Wednesday. Well, welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. I was lucky enough to be an audience member in the first British invasion when a band called the Beatles came to Chicago to play at Comiskey Park. There is another British invasion taking place of a sort of vastly different and actually funnier sort Wednesday at the Chicago Theater when the folks from My Dad Wrote a Porno arrive at the theater. This is their, they've been traveling around the country for a little while. Jamie Morton is a British television director who will not be doing that job much longer, I think, because this is such a sensation. Welcome to the show, Jamie. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, like many great ideas, the podcast and now live show of My Dad Wrote a Porno was born in a tavern, which you call, of course, a pub. That's true, isn't it?
That's absolutely true. I think all great ideas start in the pub from John Keats onwards.
So do I. You and your dad had written I'm not going to call it pornographic because it's so weirdly sort of sexual. Your dad wrote something that he sent to you and said, "Hey, son, I hope you're proud of your dad. Read this." You took it to a pub and read it to a couple of your friends, and it was hard, Jamie, to be proud of what your dad had written. As difficult as that may be to say.
That is exactly right. I mean, pride isn't something that I felt for him for quite a while, to be honest with you. He kind of wrote this. I mean, we can't even really call it a book. I mean, it's a collection of words on a page. He'd heard about the success of 50 Shades of Grey and how much money, essentially, E.L. James had made from that.
Sure.
And thought, do you know what? I could do that as well. Turns out he can't. But he had a bash anyway. And so he wrote this kind of erotic novella all about Belinda Blumenthal, who is an international sales director at Steele's Pots and Pans, which is a crockery company, which is the sexiest of industries, I think you'll agree.
Well, and also her name, if I might, Belinda Blumenthal, does not really jump off the page and rip my shirt off. Do you know what I mean?
No. Not lustful, is it, that name? It's a little bit kind of like matronly, if anything. Obviously I was appalled and disgusted, but immediately knew that I had to share it with my friends. So went down the pub, as you do, and just started to read it, basically, to James and Alice, our two mates. And they were just continually chipping in and critiquing it and having their commentary. And the podcast kind of was born right there in the pub. We actually cleared the pub out. We were shouting breasts and vagina so much that everyone around us left.
Well, wow,
that's okay, and
that's such normal pub talk anyway. I'm surprised people left.
Yeah, it must have been
really bad. Those your collaborators in this are James Cooper, who's another TV executive, and a BBC radio lass named Alice Levine. And you three have been friends since. You three have been friends for a long time, and even collaborators too. Yes.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So we all met at college. We went to the University of Leeds together. And because we're such geeks, we all joined the student TV station. Mm-hmm. And we just made loads of kind of crappy TV when we were, you know, 18, 19 years old. And we kind of just continued making stuff together. We enjoyed working together. We were kind of fellow creatives. And so we all moved down to London to start our real careers. We just carried on making stuff together in our spare time at the weekends and things. And yeah, this podcast was just the latest in a litany of unsuccessful creative endeavors.
So like I said, well, this one is not unsuccessful, Jamie Morton.
This one's been first. This one actually has worked.
Well, so you're sitting around the pub, Jamie Morton and his two friends, James Cooper and Alice Levine, and you're having a great time reading the sort of misshapen prose that your dad has offered you as his sample of his erotic kind of sensibility. When does it, after the hangover passes the next day, does one of you say, wait a minute, maybe we could do something like this? Maybe there is a podcast in this. Is that actually how it happened that fast? You had so much fun.
Yeah. It is. And I have to credit Alice with that one. Not sure she'd want that title as the person who came up with, let's share this with the world. But she did, she became, like, worryingly obsessed with my dad's book to the point where she would just read it to people in the street. And she loved it so much. She was really cajoling me to be like, we have to do something with it. We have to. And I was like, I don't know. It's my dad's erotic ramblings. Do I want to go there? But, you know, eventually she was like, come on, this is too funny not to share. And actually, it's kind of the best thing to do, is just get it out in the open and not kind of suppress it. Cause
sure.
That could be even worse for me, you know?
Let me ask you, Jamie, do your colleagues know your dad? Are they,
yes.
hang around your house?
Yes.
So what... did the three of you ask permission of your father, saying, hey, Dad, we are very interested in what you've been writing and this is what we want to do with it? How would you approach him about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I felt that because he'd given me the books in the first place, mm-hmm. he was obviously open for me to discuss it. So, yeah, I sat him down one day and I said, look, Dad, we're thinking of maybe doing a podcast about your books. And he was like, that's absolutely fantastic. Yes. What's a podcast? And I was like, oh, God. Okay. So explain what a podcast was, what we wanted to do with it. And he's just been brilliant. He's the biggest fan of My Dad Wrote Porno, which, you know.
Well, I am now.
Given that it's his work.
This week, I have become a huge fan, too, because... if nothing else, the exuberance that the three of you share, the laughter on the show is absolutely, absolutely infectious. And it is not just a straight, no, you're welcome. It's not just a straight reading of the prose, which you once characterized somewhere as he makes E.L. James sound like Jane Austen. Makes E.L. James sound like Jane Austen. But it's also the three of you, your personalities and your proclivities also enter into it in, I think, a very, very compelling way. I mean, that obviously, I'm not telling you something you don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what is so amazing about the medium of podcasting, to be honest, because it's such an intimate medium.
No question.
And it's such an emerging, way to tell a story as well. You know, it's really having a moment at the minute. I think people are really gravitating to it because of that intimacy, and you really get to feel like you know the host, and you get to get a real insight into them and their lives, not just the story that they're telling. And that was really important for us with this one particularly, because, you know, you want to make people feel like they're included in the story. It would have been quite easy to kind of make people feel a little bit at a distance, whereas we always felt that we wanted to make people feel like they were the fourth friend around the kitchen table with us, discovering this book in real time with us, so that there is no kind of like distance between us and our audience. And I think that's what has been part of the success of the show, I think.
As interesting and lively as the show is, when one begins doing a podcast, it is often like, and I'm a huge fan of podcasts, and they have a International Podcasting Festival here in Chicago, that you might indeed, during the first months or even weeks of the podcast, think that you are, you know, speaking in an empty cave. Do you know what I mean? There is not that immediate...
100%.
Yeah, there is not... But you guys have so much fun that it wouldn't matter if anybody was listening or not.
This is it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's not at all self-indulgent. I just think it is. It is euphoric. But you did get Elijah Wood. I mean, it always takes, you know, somebody on social media to, you know, the Queen Elizabeth. I don't know
if
she does tweet, but it takes someone. It takes someone with a lot of followers. To sort of hook in, and it was Elijah Wood, the star, Elijah Wood, who recommended this, and that's when it really started to take off, did it not?
That's right. That's when it kind of went to the next level, because you're right when you say that when you start out, you don't ever really think of an audience in terms of people are going to be actually listening to this.
Exactly.
It's just you and your friends, and you're just so busy trying to make each other laugh that you don't really think about an audience laughing. So then, when Elijah just tweeted about it out of the blue, and I think we were on episode 3 at the time. That just was a real game changer, because not only was it like, oh my god, Elijah Wood is listening, that's so cool because we love him.
Sure.
It was also like, oh, it's look, no longer just this British show, it's now traveling internationally.
Yes, it's like there are hundreds of thousands of people now following us. You have there have been 100 million downloads, which is a stunning and also, to me, a kind of intimidating number, because now you're sitting there in the studio, and when you had this kind of a unbelievable freedom before you, now you're thinking, I don't know if you're thinking Jamie Morton or you or James Cooper or Alice Levine are thinking, oh my God, we have like hundreds of thousands of listeners. We better be really good. Has that notion increased the pressure when you do it? And do you, I have to ask you too, do you rehearse at all before doing the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, oddly, it hasn't affected us, and maybe it should. Maybe we're just a little bit odd that we just don't really think about it to this day. I think it's such a personal story for me. I am reading my dad's pornography to my two best friends. That's so...
And hundreds of thousands of others, yeah.
Yeah, to think of, millions of people listening is a little bit intimidating, so we just kind of don't do that. Mm-hmm. And as for rehearsing beforehand, absolutely not. I mean,
that's right.
I read the chapter the day of the record just to familiarize myself with mainly my dad's poor grammar, to be honest with you, and how I'm going to actually read this stuff aloud. But James and Alice hear the chapter live on mic, and I think that's what brings so much of the spontaneity.
The spontaneity.
And the energy to the show.
The spontaneity is absolutely undeniable. Your dad, we should give credit to him, writes under the pseudonym Rocky Flintstone. Flintstone, of course, I know Rocky could come from anywhere, but it comes wonderfully from the father from the Rock on the Rockford Files show, correct?
Yeah, I know, which is so bizarre. And I've never even heard of that show. But Dad's a big fan.
Yeah,
so clearly he was inspired, you know, early doors with that one, yeah.
That's fabulous. So at some point, the buzz on this show is sufficient enough for either someone to approach the three of you and say, hey, let's take this show on the road. Then, which you did in Great Britain and I think Australia. Didn't you go to Australia?
Yeah, we did a tour in Australia. That was amazing, yeah.
Did you guys come up? Did you guys say, hey, we're having so much fun, but let's get out of the studio? Was it that simple? Or did someone come to you and say, hey, now, I think we could make this a road show. You could be the new Beatles.
Well, no one said that. It was kind of a mixture of both, actually, because we did want to do something with it, because there are so many things with this show that you can't do just through audio, because it is quite visual. And my dad describes sexual things that you just can't get your head around in audio alone.
Well, you can't actually.
Well, I'm thinking about doing something. Well, you can't do it at all, actually.
Yeah.
It's impossible. So
what about
seeing
what
it won't help you.
You're in the middle of this of a U.S. tour. How's it been so far? What did you expect from audiences? And I know that the live show incorporates video. It incorporates, you know, sort of that classic audience participation where you get audience members up on stage to shall I say, simulate some of the awkward sexuality of the show. How's it been?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, fans of the show are drawn to the show, but what I would love to see in an audience, which I may see Wednesday when you perform at the Chicago Theater at 8 o'clock, just go to Chicago Theater and buy tickets online or in person, that the people who have no idea what my dad wrote a porn must be, for the three of you, the most fascinating members of the audience, yeah?
Absolutely. And, you know, and we are always surprised as to how many people come without having any prior knowledge to the show. Because we have, you know, our diehard fans who come
to sure.
characters and are amazing. But there are a real contingent of people, yeah, who've never heard the show before. And actually, they tend to enjoy it even more because they get the absurdity really quickly. And it's just this trip because they don't really know what to expect. They don't know where it's going. And because my dad's writing style is so erratic, you don't need to have known anything about the book yes. prior to coming to the show, because it's all standalone in its own way, because these books, they make no sense.
I know.
So actually, you don't need to have known right. anything about the show.
We
always wanted it to feel like it was more of a comedy show than a podcast show, you know.
Right.
I've seen,
there's a huge difference.
Things.
No, I think that's a wise thing to do, too, because they're, you know, a live podcast show is, in many cases, nothing more than a person sitting talking into a microphone, which is not the most exciting
yeah.
thing. If you go to @dadwroteaporno, you can also there, Jamie, buy the book, can't you? If anybody is brave enough to do something like that, yeah.
it's really good to see it, you know, in print. It really, you get so much more from it because you see all of the weird grammatical errors and the spelling errors, and it really kind of brings it afresh than you kind of way that it's so awful. But yeah,
I had
a lot of fun doing that one.
I think you're really onto something, and I think as a live show, this thing has almost unlimited potential, almost the potential to get you and your pal and colleague and collaborator, James Cooper, out of the TV business for good, and the third member of this crowd, Alice Levine, out of the radio business. But a podcast is a podcast. The podcast is called My Dad Wrote a Porno. It will be performed live, and what I have read about the live show, you can listen to it before you go buy tickets if you're of that mind. The live show sounds, to my mind, really kicking it up like, you know, that was the week that was in sex and with a your dad young enough to keep writing, giving you material?
Oh, I can't stop him from writing.
I'll bet he is so empowered. It's ridiculous.
He's a man possessed. He is.
Jamie Morton, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Well, I know you've been to the States before, but this is you're part of a new cool British invasion, and I hope you sell out the Chicago Theater. I will do my part.
Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's great talking to you. I'll be in touch. Take care.
I'll see you at the show.
You bet. Don't call me out of the audience. So I'm not coming up. I know too much about these books to come up there. And Jamie, and give congratulations to your colleagues, too.
I will do.
It's a great idea. My pleasure. Thank you.